Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service to public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on Christmas when we come back. Well, 3,300 years ago, Moses instructed our fathers. He said, "You shall not have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small, and you shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small, but you shall have a perfect and a just weight, a perfect and a just measure shall you have, that your days may be lengthened in the land which the Eternal your God gives you." Well, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 followed that scriptural law when they put into our Constitution at Article 1, Section 10, these 17 words that tell us, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin, a tender in payment of debts." But in 1933, President Roosevelt took our gold away, and in 1964, President Johnson took silver coin out of circulation. Then, in place of just weights and balances, these two presidents introduced into our current practice the first, the second, and the fifth planks to the Communist Manifesto into our monetary system. They gave us Federal Reserve notes in place of gold-backed treasury bills and gold coin. And then they gave us clad coinage in place of silver coin. Now, in the intervening 70 years or so, we Americans have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation until today we're the world's number one debtor nation. Well, who do you think were the better financial planners then for our nation, Moses and our founding fathers, or Franklin D. Roosevelt and Lyndon Baines Johnson? Now, if you'd like to learn more about hard money and how to use it properly, it's another of the many lessons that we teach here in our Mosaic Law School. If you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first. That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary, a commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. And you can call right now and order yours. It's waiting for you. The number's 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Mosaic Law School is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Christmas, where does it come from? We all practice Christmas, or nearly all of us do. It's the biggest annual holy day or holiday of the year. It's religious, though, in nature, and if you stop and think about it, there's been a concerted effort over the last 20 or 30 years to abolish things that are religious from our secular life, and Christmas has been a part and parcel of public schools and our public life for at least as long as I can remember. But has Christmas always been around? How far back into history does Christmas go? Where did it get started? Who started it, and why? Is it scriptural? I looked into the Bible. I couldn't find the word Christmas anywhere. That was my first clue that it probably didn't have much to do with Christ or with the nativity described in the Bible, but then, after all, we have to look at history pragmatically. So I went to the Encyclopedia Britannica and some other secular sources and some religious sources to find out, well, what do these people tell us about the origin of such things as Christmas cards and nativity scenes and Christmas in general and St. Nicholas and Santa Claus and all of these customs, you know, the Yule logs and December the 25th. If it isn't scriptural, then what is it? And if it doesn't come from the Bible and if it doesn't have much to do with Christ and the scripture, then why are we practicing it? Where did it get its popularization? Or where did that all come from? Well, to open with, let's take a look at Christmas. It goes back to about 337 A.D. Now, remember, Jesus was born sometime prior to 337 A.D., so you'd think that if Christmas was scriptural, we'd be celebrating the birth of Jesus going back to about 4 B.C. You know, you'd think Jesus would be celebrating his birthday and his parents would be, and that there should be some references in the Gospels about Jesus and his birthday and how Jesus and the apostles celebrated Jesus' birthday year after year, kind of like the Passover. You know, you can see in the Scripture they celebrated the Passover year after year, the Feast of Tabernacles year after year, but you don't find any places where he's celebrating his birthday. I thought that was kind of strange. I mean, after all, Christmas, if it comes from the church, and the church comes to us from the seminaries, and the seminaries are the institutions of higher learning that are teaching our preachers and bishops and cardinals and popes about the Bible and Jesus and God and all of that, that those people would know. And they ought to be teaching us the truth. Well, as a holy day and as a holiday, Christmas is an amalgam of the traditions from a half dozen cultures. It's been accumulated over many centuries. A turkey dinner, for instance, and a decorated tree, Christmas cards and Santa Claus, Yule logs, mistletoe, bells, and carols originated with different peoples to become integral parts of December the 25th, a day on which no one is certain that Jesus Christ was born. So the idea of celebrating the Nativity on December the 25th was first suggested early on in the 4th century. The clever conceit of early church fathers and the Catholic Church wishing to eclipse the December 25th festivities of a rival religion that threatened the existence of Christianity at that time. And it's important to note that for 2 centuries after Christ's birth, no one knew, and fewer people even cared exactly when he was born. Birthdays were unimportant, death days were counted, and besides, Christ was divine, and Christ's natural birth was deliberately played down, as mentioned earlier. The church even announced that it was sinful to contemplate observing Christ's birthday as though he were some king or a pharaoh. Several renegade theologians, however, attempted to pinpoint the Nativity, and they came up with a confusion of dates. January 1st, January 6th, March 25th, and May 20th were all advanced as the day on which Jesus was born. Now, the latter eventually became the favorite date because of the Gospel of Luke, which states that there were shepherds who received the announcement of Christ's birth and that they were watching their sheep by night. Now, these shepherds guarded their flocks day and night at lambing time and during the summer and the fall, but not in the winter, because in the wintertime the animals were kept in corrals, and so they were unwatched. It would be highly unlikely that these shepherds would be out in the fields guarding their flocks on December the 25th, which is the rainy season in Palestine. So what finally forced the issue and compelled the church to legitimize a December the 25th date, however, was the burgeoning popularity of Christianity's major rival religion called Mithraism. Mithraism was the worship of the sun god Mithra. And on December the 25th, the pagan Romans, still in the majority, celebrated Natalis Solis Invicti, the birthday of the invincible sun god. So Mithra, or Mithras, the cult, originating in Persia and rooted itself in the Roman world in the 1st century B.C. And by about 274 A.D., Mithraism was so popular with the masses of the Roman Empire that Emperor Aurelian proclaimed it to be the official state religion. And in the early 300s, the cult seriously jeopardized Christianity, and for a time it was unclear which faith, the Mithras or the Christians, would emerge victorious. So the early Catholic Church fathers debated their options. And it was well known that Roman patricians and plebeians alike certainly enjoyed festivals of protracted nature. The tradition was established as far back as 753 BC when King Romulus founded the city of Rome on the Palatine Hill. Not only the Roman observance of Natalis Solis Invicti occasioned December feasts and parades, but so too did the celebration of the Saturnalia done in honor of Saturn, Saturn, the god of agriculture. And the church, the early Catholic Church, needed a December celebration so that they could bring all of these pagans into the early Christian church. Thus, to offer converts an occasion in which to be pridefully celebratory, the early Catholic Church officially recognized Christ's birth and to offer head-on competition to the sun worshippers' feast. The Catholic Church located the Nativity on December the 25th, and the mode of observance would be characteristically prayerful. They would conduct a mass. In fact, it would be called Christ's Mass, which is where we get the word Christmas, from Christ's Mass. It's a Roman Catholic holiday. And as one theologian wrote in the 320s, we hold this day holy not like the pagans do, because of the birth of the Son, spelled S-U-N, but because of him who made it, the Son of God, the S-O-N. Though centuries later, social scientists would write of the psychological power of group celebrations, and the unification of ranks, the solidification of collective identity, the reinforcement of common objectives, and the principle that had long been held intuitively obvious. Everybody loves a party. Now, the celebration of Christmas took permanent hold in the Western world about 337 AD, when the Roman Emperor Constantine was baptized and united for the first time the emperorship of the Roman Empire with that of the Christian Church, the Roman Catholic Church. Christianity then became the official state religion of the Roman Empire, And in AD 354, Bishop Liberius of Rome reiterated the importance of celebrating not only Christ's death, but also of Christ's birth, and Christ's birth on December the 25th. But where did mistletoe come into the game? Well, mistletoe comes into the Christmas celebration brought in by the British, or the English, in the 2nd century B.C. in the British Isles. What? 2nd century B.C., mistletoe, British Isles, Christmas celebration? How does that fit in? Well, the custom of embracing under a sprig of mistletoe, if not actually kissing under the mistletoe, originated in ancient Britain around the 2nd century B.C. It originated among the Druids and the learned class of the Celts. 200 years before Christ's birth, the Druids were celebrating, and they did in fact celebrate the start of winter by gathering mistletoe and then burning mistletoe as a sacrifice to their gods. Sprigs of this yellow-green plant with the waxy white berries were also hung in homes to ensure a year's good fortune and family harmony. Guests to a house welcomed weary travelers, and the house embraced under the auspicious sprig, the twigs of the evergreen. Outside a house welcomed weary travelers, and if enemies chanced to meet under a tree that bore mistletoe, which is, by the way, a parasite, which is usually found on deciduous and evergreen trees, these enemies were required by law to lay down their arms and forget their differences for 24 hours, about a whole day. Now, the Druids named this parasitic plant. They called it the all-healing plant, and they prescribed it for female infertility. And the mistletoe was also an antidote for poison. Gathering mistletoe was an occasion for great ceremony, and only sprigs that grew on sacred oak trees were collected. And these sprigs that were collected by the highest-ranking priests, and they were collected with gold knives, an event later dramatized in Berlini's or Bellini's opera called Norma. Mistletoe was a plant of hope, a plant of peace, a plant of harmony, not only for the Celts, but also for the Scandinavians. They called it Mistillion, and its name derived from mista, meaning dung. And since the evergreen is propagated by seeds, which is in birds' excrement, for the Scandinavians, mistletoe belonged to Frigga, the god of Friday, where we get our day Friday from Frigga, the goddess of love. And the kissing custom is thought to be rooted in this romantic association. It comes from the Scandinavians. Well, in the ancient world, mistletoe was also a decorative green. And during the Roman feasts of the Natalis Solis Invicta and the Saturnalia, patricians and plebeians alike bound sprigs into boughs, and then they festively draped these garlands throughout their houses. With the official recognition of Christmas on December the 25th in the 4th century, the Catholic Church then forbade the use of mistletoe in any form, mindful of its idolatrous associations. So as a substitute, the Catholic Church suggested holly in its place. The sharply pointed leaves were to symbolize the thorns in Christ's crown, and the red berries were to symbolize the drops of his blood. Holly then became a nativity tradition. The Christian ban on mistletoe was in effect throughout the Middle Ages, and surprisingly, as late as the 20th century. There were churches around the world, and especially in England, that forbade the wearing of mistletoe sprigs and corsages during services. But a poinsettia is very prominent now at Christmas. So where does the poinsettia come from? Well, the flower, the poinsettia, the adoption of the poinsettia as a Christmas flower is relatively recent and dates back to 1828. The poinsettia is native to Mexico. The plant is a member of the spurge family, and it has small yellow flowers surrounded high up by large tapering red leaves. These large tapering red leaves resemble petals of a flower, and they're often mistaken for flower petals. But at least as early as the 18th century, Mexicans called the plant the flower of the blessed night. And that's because of the flower's resemblance to the Star of Bethlehem. And this is the first association between the poinsettia plant and Christmas. It comes from Mexico. Well, in 1828, Dr. Joel Roberts Poinsett, the first United States ambassador to Mexico, brought the poinsettia plant into the United States, where the plant was renamed in his honor. And by the time of his death in 1851, this new plant, the poinsettia plant, flaming red color, had already established its close association with Christmas in the United States. Which brings us to the Christmas tree. Where does the Christmas tree come from? Well, it's reported to come from the 8th century in Germany. But before I get into the 8th century in Germany, why don't you write this scripture down? It's Jeremiah 10, verses 1 through 6. Jeremiah 10, verses 1 through 6. And let's tuck that one away in our hearts, and we'll read about the Christmas tree, or at least the secular history of it. And then let's see what the Bible has to say about Christmas trees. Well, the custom of a Christmas tree, undecorated, is believed to have begun in Germany in the first half of the 700s. The earliest story relates as to how a British monk and missionary by the name of Saint Boniface, his real name was Winfred, and he was born in 680 A.D. But it was while he was preaching a sermon on the Nativity to a tribe of Germanic Druids outside the town of Gessmar to convince the idolaters that the oak tree was not sacred and that the oak tree was not inviolable, the apostle of Germany felled a big oak tree on the spot. He toppled this big oak tree, and it crushed every shrub in its path except for one small fir sapling tree. It was a chance event, and a chance event can lend itself to numerous interpretations. The legend has it that Boniface, attempting to win converts, interpreted the fir survival as a miracle. It was a miracle, and he concluded, "Let this be called the tree of the Christ child." And subsequent Christ masses, or Christ masses in Germany, were celebrated by planting these fir saplings. Now, we do know with greater authority that by the 16th century, fir trees, both indoors and outdoors, were being decorated to commemorate Christmas in Germany. A forest ordinance from Amerschweier, Alsace, dated 1561, states that no burgher shall have for Christmas more than one bush of more than 8 shoes length. So the decorations hung on a tree in that time, the earliest that we have any evidence of, were roses that were cut of many colored paper, along with apples, wafers, gilt, and sugar were the earliest Christmas tree ornaments or decorations that we have from Germany. And it's widely held belief that Martin Luther, the 16th century Protestant reformer, first added lighted candles to a tree walking toward his home one winter evening. Luther was composing a sermon, and he was overawed by the brilliance of the stars twinkling amidst the evergreens. So, in order to recapture the scene for his family, Martin Luther erected a tree in the main room of his house, and then he wired its branches with lighted candles. Well, by the 17th century, or the 18th century, the Christ Baum, or Christ Tree, was a firmly established tradition in Germany. And from Germany, the custom spread to other parts of Western Europe. It was popularized in England in the 19th century by Prince Albert, that was Queen Victoria's German consort. Prince Albert was the son of the Duke of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha, a duchy in central Germany. Prince Albert had grown up decorating Christmas trees, so when he married Queen Victoria in 1840, he requested that she adopt this German tradition. So the claim of a Pennsylvania German to have initiated the Christmas tree custom in America is undisputed to this day. It's the Pennsylvania Germans who brought Christmas to the United States. And it's in the diary of Matthew Zahm of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, under the date December 20th, 1821, that the Christmas tree and its myriad decorations received their first mention here in the New World. It shouldn't be surprising, then, that, like many other festive Christmas customs, the tree was adopted so late here in America. To the New England Puritans, Christmas was sacred, and the Puritans' second governor, William Bradford, wrote that he tried hard to stamp out pagan mockery of the observance, penalizing any frivolity. The influential Oliver Cromwell preached against the heathen traditions of Christmas carols, decorated trees, and any joyful expression that desecrated that sacred event. Well, in 1659, the General Court of Massachusetts enacted a law making any observance of December the 25th other than a church service a penal offense. People were fined because they hung decorations, and that stern solemnity continued until the 19th century when the great influx of German and Irish immigrants undermined the Puritan legacy. By 1856, the poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow commented that we are in a transition state about Christmas here in New England. The old Puritan feeling prevents it from being a cheerful, hearty holiday, though every year makes it more and more so. In that year, Christmas was made a legal holiday in Massachusetts. It was the last state to uphold Cromwell's philosophy. Interestingly enough, Godey's Lady's Book, the woman's publication of the 1800s, that did so much to nationalize Thanksgiving, also played a very prominent role in popularizing the festive Christmas practice. It was the Martha Stewart of its time. And through its lighthearted and humorous drawings, its household decorating hints, its recipes for Christmas and meals, and its instructions for homemade tree ornaments, the magazine convinced thousands of housewives across America, border to border and coast to coast, that the Nativity was not just a fervent holy day, but could also be a very festive holiday as well. Which brings us now to the Greek Xmas. The familiar abbreviation for Christmas originated with the Greeks. X is the first letter of the Greek word for Christ. It's spelled X-R-I-S-T-O-S. By the 16th century, Xmas was popular throughout Europe, whereas early Christians had understood that the term merely was Greek for Christ's Mass. Later, Christians unfamiliar with the Greek reference mistook the X as a sign of disrespect, an attempt by the heathens to rid Christmas of its central meaning. For several hundred years, Christians disapproved of the use of the term Xmas, and to this day, many Christians object to the writing of Xmas in place of Christmas, or Mass of Christ. Hey, hang on, I've got to give you a reminder here. We'll be back after this reminder with Christmas cards and other Christmas pagan customs when we come back. But let me remind you in the meantime that you are listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log, our schedule, and our archives, and that can be accessed through the webpage as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Remember, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour, an editorial review, gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are talking about Christmas. Where did it come from? Why do we practice it? And another interesting sidelight is, why don't we find it in the Bible? Now, I mentioned to you Jeremiah 10. Remember that, Jeremiah 10? Listen to this. The Christmas tree is reported to have originated in Germany. Oh, I don't think so. Our people were pagans long before we got to Germany. We were practicing Christmas and Christmas trees, at least in the time of Jeremiah, which was around the 7th and 8th centuries B.C. Listen to this. In Jeremiah 10, hear you the word which the Lord, the Eternal, speaks unto you, O house of Israel. Notice this is by Jeremiah being directed at the house of Israel. That's our ancient great-great-great-great-great-granddaddies, about, 70 generations ago or so. He said, thus saith the Eternal, learn not the way of the heathen, and be not dismayed at the signs of heaven, for the heathen are dismayed at them. For the customs of the people are vain, for one cutteth a tree out of the forest, the work of the hands of the workmen with the axe. They deck it with silver and with gold. They fasten it with nails and with hammers, that it move not. They're upright as the palm tree, but they speak not. They must needs be born, because they cannot go. Be not afraid of them, for they cannot do evil, and neither also is it in them to do good. For as much as there is none like unto thee, O Eternal, thou art great, and thy name is great in might. Notice here, this Christmas tree is equated to being the work of the heathen, and we've been instructed not to learn the way of the heathen, but Prince Albert, coming from Germany, influenced his wife, Queen Victoria, in England, that we ought to practice this heathen custom that in Germany went back to at least the 7th and 8th centuries. And it went back to the 7th and 8th centuries B.C. among our people, if you trace it back to biblical times. I just thought I'd share that with you so that when you decorate your Christmas tree this year, you'll know that it's mentioned in the Bible in very uncomplimentary terms. In fact, our God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, told us not to do that. But now we've got Christmas cards. Now, where do these Christmas cards come from? Well, they come from England in 1843. Christmas cards are a relatively recent phenomenon. The sending of commercially printed Christmas cards originated in London in 1843. Previously, people had exchanged handwritten holiday greetings. First of all, they did it in person, and then they did it by way of post. And by 1822, homemade Christmas cards had become a bane of the U.S. postal system. And in that year, 1822, the superintendent of mails in Washington, D.C. complained to the Congress of the need to hire 16 extra mailmen, and fearful of future bottlenecks, he petitioned the Congress to limit the exchange of these Christmas cards by post, concluding, "I don't know what we'll do if it keeps on." Not only did it keep on, but with the marketing of attractive commercial cards, the postal burden has steadily worsened. Now, the first Christmas card designed for sale was done by London artist John Calcott Horsley. A respected illustrator of the day, Horsley was commissioned by Sir Henry Cole, a wealthy British businessman who wanted a card that he could proudly send to his friends and to his professional acquaintances to wish them a Merry Christmas. Well, Sir Henry Cole was a prominent innovator in the 1800s. Cole modernized the British postal system. He managed construction of the Albert Hall, arranged for the Great Exhibition in 1851, and then oversaw the inauguration of the Victoria and Albert Museum. Most of all, Cole sought to beautify life, and in his spare time he ran an art shop on Bond Street, specializing in decorative objects for the home. Well, in the summer of 1843, Cole commissioned Horsley to design an impressive Christmas card for that year's Christmas. Horsley produced a card, and each of the two sides of the card, the side panels, depicted a good work, a good deed, clothing the naked and feeding the hungry. The centerpiece of the card featured a party of adults and children with plentiful food and drink. There was much and severe criticism from the British temperance movement against this practice at that time. The first Christmas card's inscription read, "Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to you." Merry, M-E-R-R-Y, was then a spiritual word meaning blessed or blessed, as in Merry Old England. Of the original 1,000 cards printed in 1843 for Cole, 12 exist today in private collections. Printed cards soon became the rage in England. Then they were taken to Germany. But it required an additional 30 years for Americans to take on the idea. In 1875, Boston lithographer Louis Prang, he was a native from Germany, he began publishing cards, Christmas cards, and earned the title Father of the American Christmas Card, Louis Prang. Well, Prang's high-quality Christmas cards were costly, and they initially featured not such images as the Madonna and Child, or a decorated tree, or even a Santa Claus, but rather they included colored floral arrangements of roses, daisies, gardenias, geraniums, and apple blossoms. Americans took to Christmas cards in a big way, but not to Prang's Christmas cards. And Prang was forced out of business in 1890. It was the cheap penny Christmas postcards that were imported from Germany that remained the vogue until World War I. And by the end of World War I, America's modern greeting card industry had been born. Today, more than 2 billion Christmas cards are exchanged annually here in the United States. Christmas is the number one card-selling holiday of the year. Now, where did Santa Claus come from? Santa Claus arrives post-4th century Europe. But there's another place that the word Santa Claus, or Nicholas, or Nicolaitans occurs. And that's in Revelation, again, in the Bible, in Revelation 2 and 3. We find a doctrine of the Nicolaitans. So let me share with you in chapter 2 of Revelation, verse 6. But this, or thus, hast thou hated the deeds of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate. The Nicolaitans are mentioned in the Bible. They're mentioned again in chapter 2, verse 15. So hast thou also them that hold the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, which thing I hate. Now notice here, the doctrine of this Nicolaitans he hates, this doctrine of Christmas or the Christmas tree, he says is a pagan custom, and he tells us not to learn of it in Jeremiah chapter 10, verses 1 through 6. So now twice in the scripture we've been instructed by God himself concerning this pagan practice of Christmas. Now haven't we? Well, let's take a look at Santa Claus. The original Santa Claus, St. Nicholas, was born in the ancient southeastern Turkish town of Lycia early in the 4th century.
And to show his piety as a child, he adopted a self-imposed twice-weekly fast on Wednesdays and Fridays. Then upon the early death of his parents, he fully dedicated his life to Christ, entering a Lycian seminary, and it was on a boat journey to Palestine that he is supposed to have extended his arms and stilled a violent sea, the first of his many miracles. Later, he would become the patron saint of sailors. Well, excuse me, boys and girls, but it seems to me that sometime prior to the 4th century, another fellow stilled a raging sea. Wasn't that Jesus? Didn't we see one of Jesus' miracles, the calming of the storm on the sea? Well, then, who is this Santa Claus, this St. Nicholas, coming in here to steal God's thunder? Well, at an early age, Nicholas was appointed Bishop of Myra in Asia Minor. His success in winning converts and his generosity toward the poor incensed the local Roman officials. And during a great Christian persecution, this St. Nicholas was imprisoned and tortured under orders of the despotic Roman Emperor Gaius Diocletianus. The ruler, after a reign of terror and profligacy, abruptly abdicated at age 60 in favor of the simple life of farming and raising cabbages. Well, this pleased many Romans, and it was most fortunate for Nicholas because the new emperor, Constantine, would later convert to Christianity. Well, this emperor, Constantine, freed the bishop, and when Constantine convened the first church council in Nicaea in 325, Nicholas attended as a prominent member. Nicholas is believed to have died on December the 6th, 342 AD, and eventually was adopted as the patron saint of Russia, Greece, and Sicily. So, St. Nicholas, then, comes from Roman Catholicism. He's a Roman Catholic bishop, and he was immortalized as a bishop. Now, two aspects of St. Nicholas' life led to his becoming Santa Claus. It was his generosity. His generosity was legend, and he was particularly fond of children. And we know this primarily through Roman accounts of his patronage of youth, which eventually led to his becoming the patron saint of children throughout the Middle Ages and well beyond. And he was referred to by many names, none of them, however, Santa Claus. Notice here that he was particularly fond of children, and he has become the patron saint of children. And in Boston, Massachusetts, these same Catholic clergy to this day are the patron saints of children, only today we call them pedophiles and sodomites. And the Catholic Church in Boston admitted that one-third of the clergy, this is what they admitted to in their own public documents, one-third of the clergy in Boston is either homosexual, sodomites, or pedophiles. Now, I suppose that only occurs in the Catholic Church in Boston, and that it doesn't occur in the Catholic Church in Chicago, or Rome, or Los Angeles. Now, does it? Or does it? Children today would not at all recognize the Saint Nick who brought gifts to European children hundreds of years ago, except perhaps for his cascading white beard. He made his rounds in full red and white bishop's robes, complete with twin-peaked mitre and crooked crozier. He was pulled by no fleet-footed reindeer, but coaxed an indolent donkey, and he arrived not late on Christmas Eve, but on his Christian Peace Day, December the 6th. The gifts that he left beside the hearth were usually small and disappointing by today's standards, things like fruits, nuts, hard candies, wood and clay figurines. They were better, though, than the gifts later European Santas would leave. During the Protestant Reformation of the 16th century, St. Nicholas was banished from most European countries. Replacing him were more secular figures, such as Britain's Father Christmas and France's Papa Noel. Neither was known as a lavish gift giver to children, who in general were not at center stage at that point in history. Father Christmas, for instance, was more the fictive sponsor of adult feats concerned with amour. The Dutch kept the St. Nicholas tradition alive as the protector of sailors. St. Nicholas graced the prow of the first Dutch ship that arrived in America, and the first church built in New York City was named after St. Nicholas. Now, the Dutch brought with them to the New World two Christmas items that were quickly Americanized. In 16th century Holland, children placed wooden shoes by the hearth the night of St. Nicholas's arrival. The shoes were filled with straw, a meal for the saint's gift-laden donkey. In return, Nicholas would insert a small treat into each clog. In America, the limited volume shoe was replaced with the expandable stocking hung by the chimney, with expectations care would not come until 1822. Now, the Dutch spelled Nicholas S-I-N-T, Sint Nicholas, N-I-K-O-L-A-S-S, which in the New World became Sinterklaas. Sinterklaas. So when the Dutch lost control of New Amsterdam to the English in the 17th century, Sinterklaas was anglicized by the English to Santa Claus, spelled S-A-N-T-A-C-L-A-U-S. Now, much of modern-day Santa Claus lore, including the reindeer-drawn sleigh, originated in America due to the popularity of a poem by a New York theology professor. Dr. Clement Clark Moore composed The Night Before Christmas in 1822 to read to his own children on Christmas Eve. Well, the poem might have remained privately in the Moore family if a friend had not mailed a copy of that poem, without authorization, by the way, to a newspaper. It was picked up by other newspapers when it appeared in magazines, and then eventually every line of the poem's imagery became part of the Santa legend. Well, Dr. Moore, who was a classical scholar for many years, believed that for him to acknowledge having written a child's poem might damage his professional reputation. So, as a result, Dr. Moore did not publicly admit authorship of the poem The Night Before Christmas until 1838, by which time just about every child in America could recite the poem by heart. It was in America that Santa put on weight, and the original Saint Nicholas had been a tall, slender, elegant bishop, and that was the image perpetrated for centuries by the Catholic Church. But this new rosy-cheeked, roly-poly Santa Claus is credited to the influential 19th-century cartoonist Thomas Nast. From 1863 until 1886, Nast created a series of Christmas drawings for Harper's Weekly. These drawings, executed over 20 years, exhibit a gradual evolution in Santa Claus from the pudgy, diminutive, elf-like creature of Dr. Moore's immortal poem to the bearded, pot-bellied, life-size bell ringer familiar on every street corner in America today. Nast's cartoons also showed the world how Santa spent his entire year by constructing toys, checking on children's behavior, reading their requests for special gifts. A godlike image, and his images were incorporated into the Santa Claus lore. But what about Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer? Well, that came in 1939 in Chicago. Rollo the Red-Nosed Reindeer, Reginald the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Both of these names were considered for the most famous reindeer of all, and the now traditional Christmas song began as a poem, a free handout to department store shoppers. It was in 1939. The Montgomery Ward department store in Chicago sought something novel for its Santa Claus to distribute to parents and children. Robert May, an advertising copywriter for the store, suggested an illustrated poem printed in a booklet that families would want to save and reread every holiday season. So May conceived the idea of a shiny-nosed reindeer, a Santa's helper, and an artist friend, Denver Gillen, spent hours at a local zoo creating whimsical sketches of reindeer at rest and play. Montgomery Ward executives approved the sketches and May's poem, but they nixed the name Rollo, and then they nixed the name Reginald, and many considered other names to preserve the alteration, and they finally settled on Rudolph, the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the preference of his four-year-old daughter. And that Christmas of 1939, 2.5 million copies of Rudolph's booklet were handed out in the Montgomery Ward retail stores across the country. Rudolph was reprinted as a Christmas song or book sporadically until 1947. But it was in that year, 1947, that a friend of May's, a fellow by the name of Johnny Marks, decided to put the poem to music. And a professional singer, or one professional singer after another, who heard the lyrics and reviewed the song, declined the opportunity to record the song until Gene Autry consented in 1949. So Gene Autry, in 1949, the Autry recording rocketed to the top of the hit parade, and since then, more than 300 different recordings of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer have been made, and more than 80 million records have been sold. The original Gene Autry version of the record, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, is second only to Bing Crosby's White Christmas as the best-selling record of all time. Rudolph became an annual television star and a familiar Christmas image in Germany, Holland, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, England, Spain, Austria, and France, and many of the countries whose own lore had enriched the international St. Nicholas legend. Perhaps most significantly, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. It has been called by sociologists the only new addition to the folklore of Santa Claus in the 20th century. Well, there's a thumbnail sketch of the history of Christmas. It's a pagan secular holiday. It is a day, it is a practice. It is a holy day that is condemned in the scripture. In fact, not only did Jeremiah in Jeremiah 10 condemn it, and John in the book of Revelation, but also we see in Isaiah chapter 1, Isaiah the prophet. In Isaiah chapter 1, about verse 10, he makes comment concerning our holy days or our holidays. It says, "Hear the word of the Eternal, you rulers of Sodom, and give ear unto the law of our God, you people of Gomorrah. To what purpose is this multitude of your sacrifices unto me, says the Eternal? I am full of the burnt offerings of rams and of the fat of fed beasts, and I delight not in the blood of bullocks or of the lambs or of the he-goats. Now when you come to appear before me, who hath required this at your hand to tread my courts? Bring no more these vain oblations. The incense is an abomination unto me, and your new moons and Sabbaths, the calling of assemblies, I cannot away with. It is iniquity, even the solemn meeting. Your new moons and your appointed feast days, my soul hateth. They're a trouble to me, and I am weary to bear them." Now that's what your God thinks of Christmas, Easter, New Year's, your holy days, your religious festivals. But he says a little more. He goes on to say in verse 15, "When you spread forth your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. And yes, when you make many prayers, I will not hear, and your hands are full of blood. Now wash you and make yourselves clean, and put away the evil of your doings from before my eyes, and cease to do evil." Boys and girls, Christmas is evil. "And learn to do well, and seek judgment. Relieve the oppressed, judge the fatherless, plead for the widow. Come now, and let us reason together, says the Eternal. And though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be white as snow. And though they be red like crimson, they shall be as wool. If you be willing and obedient, you shall eat the good of the land. But if you refuse, and if you rebel, you shall be devoured with the sword. For the mouth of the Eternal has spoken it." Now that's quite an indictment. You want to practice Christmas, Easter, and New Year's, you will be devoured by war. And now we're being devoured by war in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's a prophecy that's come to pass before your eyes and in your ears. Well, so much for Christmas today. We'll pick it up there next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Let me remind you that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.